This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, I'm doing well. Your audio's clicking through. We're going to see whether or not it straightens itself out.
Well, testing, 1, 2, 3, look at that.
Yeah.
That sucks,
all...
okay.
Okay, now it's good again.
Oh, all right.
All right.
All right.
We're surviving for the moment.
Yep.
Yeah, is it still clicking?
No, now right, we seem to be fine.
Okay. Great.
All right.
All right.
Good.
Well, how are
good
you doing otherwise?
Voice.
Yeah, there we go.
Everything is all is well.
All right. Well, I was looking through some of the news articles that I read every week that kind of fly through my email and on some of the news sites that I look at. And I came across a really interesting article in Psychology Today, which
okay.
is one of the popular psychology articles. Mm-hmm. And this was actually a refreshing article. The title of it was Evolutionary Psychology is a Superpower.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It turns out this is a writer for Psychology Today who attended the Heterodox Psychology Conference in Southern California.
Okay.
For which the keynote speakers were Lita Cosmides and John Tooby.
Ah. Okay.
So this guy reviews this conference, and it's just incredible. He basically says that evolutionary psychology is a superpower. Well, this was John Tooby when he said in his presentation that evolutionary mm-hmm. psychology is a superpower, and he explains – he goes through this article, which I'm going to put up. It's put up on the Facebook group, the Fans of the Beat Your Genes podcast, and I'll also put it up in the show notes for the website beatyourgenes.org.
Yeah.
But he basically goes through and says that John Tooby's points that – unveiled the superpower is there's a couple of them, but one of the really interesting ones I hadn't thought about before is that large scale politics are such a mess, partly because the human mind only evolved to deal with small scale politics.
Right.
I thought in the context of, you know, the sky is falling with all the, you know, political things going on nowadays, which I've stopped keeping track of, it makes perfect sense.
Yes. Yes. All good. I'm glad to hear that. I actually, I didn't say this, but about, 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, I had the opportunity to have dinner with Tooby and Cosmides. And I actually spent 5 hours with them. We started at 5:30 and we went till 10:30.
Wow.
And it was terrific. It was they're very different personalities. John Tooby is a very quiet, reserved, he's very careful, chooses his words very carefully. Deeply thoughtful, systematic. I mean, he's obviously a great mind. And then his wife Lita, who's just lovely, is just there's 1,000 words a minute coming out of there, and it's coming fast and furious. And she's processing every nuance of what's going on in her mind right out of her mouth. So you better be paying attention, or you're gonna miss it. So in their household, she wins 10-1, but his ore is, you know, is richer ore, so it all winds up even. But there's something to listen to. They were not really aware of, you know, they certainly were aware in principle that clinical psychology could use evolutionary psychology. Obviously, they knew that had to be so, but they weren't aware that anybody was applying it. And so I was explaining some of the things that I do, and they were, you know, they seemed interested, but they're gracious people. So they were uh, But it was a lot of fun. I got to check a lot of my own thinking against what they had to say, and it was a pleasure. It was one of the, it's kind of like if you were a music person and you got to meet Paul McCartney, I mean, that would be really cool. And I got to meet these folks, and I thank my friend Henry for setting this up. It was just a terrific thing.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah, every person that I meet who has some sort of interest when we start talking about evolutionary psychology, if they really are interested rather than arguing about status, I give I send them the Evolutionary Psychology Primer by Lee DeConcini and John Tooby. And every time they read it, everybody gets in touch and says, oh my God, it blew their mind. And then next they're on the David bus and everything that you've had in your website. So it's just incredible.
Yes. All cool. So yeah, I got to brag about that. I had forgotten last week to brag about that on the show. And I got off the mic. How did I forget to brag about that? So I'm glad you reminded me because I'd forgotten again. Now I got it in there. All right. All right. What are we up to?
Well, today we're talking about different questions. We got three main questions, and if we have time, we're going to go through some more. But the main questions, we're going to just start from the top. And this is about being productive. Dr. Lyle, I struggle to be productive and accomplish my goals unless I create a ton of urgency in my mind. Unfortunately, I can't conjure up this kind of urgency all the time. However, I know that I can do better if I apply myself. Are my strategies to get myself to do the work just not complete enough? I want to accomplish effort and organization, but I never seem to be able to stick with my plans. Do I just need to plan in even more detailed ways so that I figure out all the ways I'm failing to stick to the plan and then shore up those weak moments? You've talked before on the show about strategies to learn large amounts of information or go through a lot of work to get a job. But can you go into detail on what this looks like practically?
Yeah, this looks a little different than those things. So what we're looking at here is let's back up the camera up for just a second, and let's ask ourselves the question, why does anybody do anything? And the answer as to why they do anything is cost-benefit analysis. And so if they can't find themselves sticking to the plan, it's because layers of their brain are running the cost-benefit analysis on all of their behavioral options, and the little details of the plan and the plan itself doesn't seem like it's worth doing. So in print, what the plan is it's a hypothesis about what might be worth doing. And the person is spending a fair amount of time sort of thinking that through, kind of mapping it out in their mind, and then thinking, okay, that's probably a good idea, and maybe I ought to do it. Okay, but the person is really not, the whole mind is not convinced. And there's reasons why it's not convinced. There's the most fundamental and the most gross level analysis of the problem is the cost-benefit analysis. So this is where I like to use the Auschwitz experiment. So if the Germans told you, okay, you have to execute this plan and do all the details associated with this plan, and you have to do it meticulously every waking hour that you can afford to do it, if you are, as long as you're not sleeping and you're not chewing food and not taking a shower, not pooping, you're working on this plan. And if you do this for the next 18 months, then we let you walk across the river into Switzerland. And if you don't, you're dead. Now, would you do it? You would. Why? Because of the cost-benefit analysis. So a lot of times when I'm listening to somebody say, gosh, I just feel like I can't do this, or, it's just so hard to get this done, and it's well within their abilities to do it, my first question is, are we in Auschwitz or are we not in Auschwitz? Okay, how badly do you want this? Like, how important is it to you? And the answer is, well, they've got multiple goals and multiple agendas, and they've got all kinds of things that they might want to do that compete with this for time and energy. And so, that's why the plan is going awry, because it's really not that necessarily worth it. Now, there are other reasons that can stop us. So I'll talk about two that are primary, that can essentially stop us on our way to something, and that sometimes we need to take out the magnifying glass and check it out. One is that your mind can detect something in an overall plan. There is something in there, some part of the chain of events and actions that are going to be required to be successful is something that you're not sure that you can do. And that is gumming up the works. It's a bottleneck for the motivational system. You can sniff that you can do step one, step two, three, and four, but somewhere out there in step five, there's a mess and you're not so sure that you can handle it. And so you're avoiding all of it, even though you can see that if you got through step five, you can do steps 6 through 16, which would take you 80% of the way to the goal. Then there'd be a snag at 17, but you'd have so much momentum, it would be so worth it to finish that you would get it done. But the problem is there's a snag at step 6, and you can sense it, okay? Might require more money than you're willing to spend on it. Maybe it's going to cost $800 instead of the $300 that you have earmarked for the project, whatever it is. And so as a result, or may require abilities that you're not sure that you can do, or that you can buy or manage or create, you know, and learn, et cetera. So we could be stopped by low self-efficacy. So therefore, we chain our way through or make a list of all the micro goals that are going to be required to get to the outcome, and we see whether or not we can solve them in principle. And so then we look at that thing and we see if there's something in there that are essentially our subconscious mind is circling around and throwing up as a red flag that is gumming up the works of our motivation. So that's another thing. A third thing, and another major factor in why people don't produce towards worthwhile goals, is the ego trap. So once again, this is being driven by some degree of uncertainty with respect to the person's self-efficacy. So they're not sure that they can achieve it, and they most goals that are worthwhile, you are not sure that you can achieve. There's a degree of uncertainty about whether or not it will be possible, and the reason is that most goals that you are attempting to achieve that are worthwhile are sitting under competitive pressure, and because they're almost always about esteem process. So we're attempting to earn esteem, and the esteem that's worth earning is going to be the esteem that we will earn towards the end of our reach in terms of our abilities. So we're going to set the bar pretty high, or it's not going to feel exciting. But when we set the bar high, the whole point of the high bar is that it's pushing our assessment of our own ability to do it. And so as a result of that, we can also feel like that goal would be a worthy demonstration of who it is that we are. But the problem is that other people may already think that we can do it. And so for them, it would just be an obvious affirmation. But for us, it's more than an obvious affirmation. It's actually a challenge that we're not sure that we can accomplish. And so we run the cost-benefit analysis on whether or not it's worth putting out the time and energy and trying to attempt to do this thing. Because not only is it a time and energy issue, but it is also an esteem risk issue. So we could wind up losing more esteem than the esteem that we have to gain. Or we could wind up potentially putting at risk enough esteem that the esteem gain versus minus the potential esteem loss is a net total gain, that we have to run that analysis against the time and energy that's involved with the activity in the first place. And so as a result, and all multiplied by the probability of success with the whole operation. So as a result, we can see that there's a cost-benefit analysis that isn't simply our questions about self-efficacy, and it's not simply a question about how worthwhile or what the gains would be if we were able to achieve it, and it's not just about how much energy is going to be required to achieve it, but it's also about whether or not there's status loss that is potentially involved by us attempting something and failing. So all of this is, these are all the reasons why we have the mess that we have with respect to someone's situation that they just described. So I have, I'm quite confident that if I were to speak to this individual and we were to find out what goal it was that they were talking about, and the scatterbrained, half-assed attempts that they were making in order to do this, and that they get sidetracked and don't put out the energy, et cetera, we're going to find at the root of it, there's going to be essentially undigested elements of uncertainty to the self-efficacy. There's going to be, and thereby, there's snags that you can smell that you're not sure whether or not you can do, that all by itself throws a monkey wrench into your ability to do a cost-benefit analysis on the whole operation. You can't analyze what your odds of success are because there's too many variables, and you can't analyze what energy and the costs are going to be involved, et cetera. So essentially, when we get right down to it, the reason why anybody or anything, any animal ever does anything is behind cost-benefit analytics. That's what the brain is it's actually a cost-benefit analytic engine. And what it uses for data is it uses its sensory inputs from the environment alongside its memory systems. And those two things together are inputs into a cost-benefit calculus where it is weighing its options for behavior and attempting to arrive at the most efficient payoff for gene survival with respect to every unit of energy that it's going to put out. So what looks like just a personality foible or just being a flake or any of this kind of thing actually is very deeply engineered by wordless survival and reproductive algorithms that are built into the brain. That's what the motivational problem is, and the solution to the problem is going to be precision over the parameters. So it's actually being willing to take a deep breath, face the ego trap, roll up our shirt sleeves, and really analyze, are there things that we don't know? Are there things that we're not sure that we can do? Analyze what the cost is of public failure. If we put out that energy, look at what the whole upside is versus the loss downside as well as the energy output, and find out whether or not we can get increasing precision on the payoff matrix or the payoff estimation, the motivational efficiency of this particular goal. And what we often will find with a goal that's been swirling around in somebody's head for a while, maybe years, is that there's a lure there that their mind is analyzing that this may well be a very worthwhile thing to do, but it's got parameters that they haven't investigated. They're kind of afraid of investigating it. There's ego trap issues. There's also time and trouble and energy that it would take to actually even do the parametric estimation. So there are other competing agendas. There's other things that they could do with their time and energy. So there's all kinds of things that get in the way of a seemingly worthwhile goal being executed. And but when we start to strip away some of the things that are getting in between, we find one of two things happens. We find that the person either becomes more inspired and attacks the goal more aggressively, or they look more carefully at the cost-benefit analysis when they get more information and say to themselves, you know what, it's really not worth doing. It's not worth doing now under the conditions that are available to me. And that's fine. So now what happens is that the mind quits turning to this as often because the analysis of the motivational efficiency of that course of action has been vetted more carefully, and now its excitement is toned down because the motivational efficiency is judged to be too low to be worried about executing. So this happens in the business world a lot. Some guy has 47 properties, you know, in his company, and he's got, you know, a potential project where he's going to build a McDonald's over there and a car wash in some other lot, and then he's got a little shop strip mall that he wants to put in Bridgeport, et cetera. And he's looking at the local economies, and he's got data coming in, and he'll have some project that's just going to sit there for 6 years. And then something happens, somebody builds an Indian casino, and suddenly he's like, God, guess what? Time to put in the gas station over on that corner that we own, you know, that we own on, you know, Central Avenue in Galt, California. Suddenly we know, hey, it's worth doing. Okay? So this is very many goals in life are backburnered and fiddled with until the parameters come up. But for a person who feels like, I'm almost ready to shut up. But for a person who feels
it's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay. For a person who feels like they've got a nagging sense that they're letting life pass them by and they are not actually get down to something that's important, I would have them look very carefully at the ego trap. In other words, do we fear the fact that we're going to look foolish and lose status if we fail? If that's a significant factor in the equation, then I would encourage that individual, you know what I'm saying, to look carefully at this and to, go to the McDougal website and look at my videos. I had one that I did in January of 2016 called The Slow Fast Way, and it's the story of weight loss. But it's really not weight loss. It's really the story of the ego trap. And I have other videos, I think, on my website. Success Forces also talks about this to some degree. But the ego trap is a punishing and very unfortunate byproduct of elegant human status defense. And we had to have it in the system. It was obviously evolutionarily useful to be very careful about finding out when we thought others thought that we could do things that we weren't sure that we could do. And so even though they might be worth achieving to demonstrate those abilities or get the goods that would be resultant from those attempts, it is dangerous to possibly lose that status. And we can feel what it feels like we're in one of those situations where we feel the embarrassment and the fear of social status loss by potentially failing. So that if that is part of the counter motivation towards a worthwhile goal, then that is really worth attacking. Okay? It's really worth saying to go through the analytics and go through the mental exercise of what do I really have to lose, and who is going to laugh at me, and what will be the social costs, and how long will those costs last? I believe that one of the reasons that the ego trap is as potentially destructive as it can be in human life today is because it has a sticky quality to it. In evolution that doesn't exist today, and therefore in evolutionary history, we had to be careful because a substantial loss could sit inside that social village for a long time. And so whenever we were overrated, it would make us as careful as possible about not disproving that delusion that people had about us. But when we did disprove it, if we got forced into it, which we usually did, we had to perform. We had to go out and hunt again, even though we had been lucky at a previous hunt. We won the rock skimming contest against somebody that's better than us, but it turned out we just got a lucky break. So the point is that the defense to be careful about trying to go after goals when we're not sure that we can get them. You know, the cost becomes so much higher when other people are confident that we can achieve them. And so that puts us in a motivational bind. And in the Stone Age, it's very possible that the status losses and gains were sticky. Now, I don't know. I don't know that any anthropologist, you know, has been paying attention to this issue. But I do actually have some interesting evidence that has been reported that just occurred to me. From a cultural anthropologist that went and lived with some a man and a woman anthropologist went and lived with a group of people. And when they did, the village was small that they were with. But they actually were able to find out that both the male and the female independently asked the males and the females about who in the village had ever slept with whom. And it turns out that the reports were 100% concordant. In other words, everybody in that village knew who everybody else in that village had ever slept with. Now, that's astonishing.
Wow.
Okay? So when you think about that, you realize, look out. In a Stone Age village, everybody knows what you tried to do. Everybody knows what you failed at. Everybody knows. And so we carry, I believe, that anxiety that if we try something and we fail, everybody knows, and everybody knows forever. Okay? That's a delusion in the modern environment. Not everybody knows, for one thing, and nobody cares, and everybody's so damn busy and self-absorbed that they're not going to pay very much attention. You can fail 6 times, no problem. Maybe you succeed on the 7th. So there's as a result, you know, whenever I sniff, I got a big nose. Anybody's ever met me knows that. Okay? And that big nose was designed by nature to sniff out the ego trap. I can smell it on people when I'm working with them. And I'm trying to look for it. I don't always get it. Sometimes it's there and I didn't see it. But I'm looking for it. Okay? I'm looking to find out, are you afraid to try to improve in this area of your life where you are bored, i.e. not excited with the level of achievement that you have now, or depressed, i.e. that you are below the level of achievement that you reasonably think that you should be able to get, and you're confused and demoralized as to why you're not getting it, or you bitter, i.e., you know, you're in the ego trap, and you are feeling very disturbed about that motivational dynamic in your life and how it is that you're letting your life slip away, and somehow, for some reason, you've got this crippling self-doubt that is checkmating your ability to make the most of yourself. So that whenever I smell that, like, my job is to try to convince that person, wait a minute, what do we have to lose? Okay, you're not going to lose my respect if we try to break this problem down, find out the fundamentals that you're afraid that you may not be able to execute, and we go for it and we give it a shot. We'll learn something. We may lose some time and energy, and maybe there's some money involved. Let's make sure we can afford it. But let's sure as hell give it a shot, and let's see what we can learn and whether or not we can grow. Okay, that's the attitude. As long as we can afford the loss, the only losses you can't afford are physical injury, you know, death, and maybe money. But you can sure as hell afford the status loss. Okay, so that's what we want to that's the instinct where we want to beat the genes, right there. And so this, you know, I didn't realize what an important question this person asked, because it goes all over human motivation and all over the human condition. And so that's, you know, be on red alert for your own ego trap, because that's one that we want to. See if we can find a way to think our way through that thing and think our way out of it, because that's worth getting out of. You know, the rest of it, whether the cost is worth it, you know, whether the upside is worth the risk of time and energy, whether or not our low self-efficacy or low confidence with respect to it, you know, can be changed with examination of new information or a cost estimate of what it's going to take to solve that little link in the chain that may be holding up the show. All of those things are legitimate questions of cost-benefit analysis. The ego trap is naturally an important part of the cost-benefit analysis, but it's overrated by our current nervous systems, and it's a distortion as to what it's really going to cost us to attack it and essentially be willing to face that potential loss. We overestimate the losses there, and therefore our lives too often wind up impoverished because we do not pin our ears back and go for things that are well worth going for.
Wow.
All right.
Fantastic.
Good. I've said my piece on that. Good. We can move on.
Do you mind if I ask you a couple of follow-up questions that kind of popped in my head?
Absolutely. You bet.
So with the ego trap, I've just kind of noticed, because as you talk about the ego trap the last couple of years, I scan back in my life and I've tried to be around people who don't create an ego trap around me, surrounding different things.
Yeah.
It seems like the people who tend not to do that overwhelmingly in my own life were people who were into sports. And so I don't know what that is. Maybe it's just that the highly competitive environment allows for people just to not care because they kind of realize that, you know, everyone's going to be bad when they first start and as they practice more. But I wonder if there's something that I'm missing there that's not has to do with sports, but just maybe the highly openness or the disagreeability where people really just aren't paying attention.
I don't think there's anything magic about sports that influences personalities or anything else under the sun, but I will say this, and that is sports is an unusual domain of human life where there's no hiding from the outcomes in the competition. It's all about the competition. And you can attempt to posture that you're not trying very hard, but if the other guy is going to go ahead, if he's not going to respect that posturing and he's not intimidated, he'll just go ahead and try to beat you anyway. And so you kind of have to not be posturing and pretending like you are not trying hard. Okay? Now, people do this, and so even on huge stages, you will occasionally see the ego trap raise its head. I've seen Kobe Bryant make sure he was posturing and make sure that he was looking like he wasn't trying hard when he was actually in some stiff competition. That's a first A-list narcissist who would pull that kind of stunt even. You know, right out in front of 20,000 people, he would do that. I saw an event that took place. I forget what it was, and I believe it was a match race. Possibly was it between Michael Johnson and some sprinter? I can't remember. There was some kind of a match race, and I believe it was the great 220 men. I think that's who it was, Michael Johnson, if I'm remembering. And there was a 100-meter champion, and they had a match race. And half, you know, it was going to be 150 yards to really see the fastest human. I think people were fascinated with, I may be remembering the man's name wrong, but it
Donovan
has,
Bailey.
In my, yeah, but I mean, I think Michael Johnson is the name of that great sprinter from 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. I believe it was Donovan Bailey. I think Bailey, when they ran this race, Johnson pulled up at, you know, 75 yards or whatever it was when he was getting beat. And Bailey said, I knew he was going to do that. Okay. I knew he was going to pull up if I started beating him. And of course, Johnson is like, hey, I've got a quadricep problem now. And it's like, well, who's going to call him a liar? Well, Bailey did, but we'll never know. But it didn't surprise me that happened. And I believe that it was probably an ego trap process, that the world had been blown away by Johnson's performance in the Olympics. I think he spoke the 220, maybe the 440. I mean, he is a very unusual runner, spectacular, you know, world champion. I mean, he was something special. But the world then wanted to test his limits, like, hey, are you actually better than the 100-meter champion? You know what I mean? And the answer was no. No, he wasn't. But that's why they didn't put it at 100 meters, and that's why it wasn't running 100 meters. So they put the race at 150, but it turns out now 100 meters runner was going to beat him at 150 meters. And he didn't want the world to see that, and so what do we get? Now, could I be wrong? Sure. But it's sure curious that in 100 other races that where he's running 220 yards, we don't pull up with an injury. That was the day we pulled up with an injury. So this is not to degrade this person at all. This is to show you that if you put enough chips on the line for just about anybody, even in sport, you're going to wind up in situations where people are essentially forced to defend their status just because they've got too much to lose. But usually in sports, you don't have a kind of a hokey situation like that. And so sportsmen and women don't have anywhere to hide. And so that's a place where you have to put it all out on the line, and the world gets to see who wins and who loses. Okay, and that's the way it is.
Wow.
So that's maybe part and parcel of some of the things that you've seen in your life with people that are into sports. And perhaps they also have enough competitiveness that they are willing to engage in competitions, and they are possibly willing to lose if they lose, and they're the people that he would engage in such things may be more psychologically resilient to those kinds of losses potentially, and essentially so that could be in the equation. I don't know, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I timed it wrong.
No worries.
No, I like hearing it.
So anyway, that's it. Did you have some other follow-up question?
I was curious if you thought that highly disagreeable people were more prone to become in the ego trap, whereas more highly agreeable people may be more likely to not try as hard because they're satisfied with the level of status are currently achieved with a particular goal.
I have no idea, and I wouldn't have thought that, except for the possibility that more disagreeable people are, that they're in general going to be miscalibrated. But that would mean that they would be willing to swing for fences, and they would be more likely to fail, just because they're going to generally probably going to be miscalibrated. I would think, but that miscalibration wouldn't cause them to necessarily have these sort of dual or this underlying cost-benefit analytic machine saying, wait a second, I don't think we can do it, but they think we can. So I don't see that it necessarily fits into a personality style, but it would be – this could be – if somebody ever looked at Carol Dweck's work with mindset theory with kids, they could – I mean, the general main effect is, does the social – environment put the bar too high for you, and that's what creates the ego trap effect. They don't call it that; they just call it this. It's the mindset effect. But I don't think anybody has thought to throw the big five at this. I don't think as much of a personality dynamic. Although I wouldn't be surprised if there's some personality dynamics in it. But it's not so much a personality dynamic as it is a general systems dynamic of human nature.
Hmm.
So in principle, anybody can be put in the ego trap. The an example of this was John Wooden. So John Wooden was a relentless teacher of fundamentals and a relentless champion of the idea that our job is to be as good as we can be, to practice as well as we can, and we're going to let the game take care of itself. And whether we win or lose, whatever. He says, I want to win, but what I really want is for us to have reached our potential. So this is sort of one of the great sages, you know, of all time. That this is what made him an extraordinary teacher of humans, is this concept. Now, what's interesting is that he told some friend of his that pretty soon, by the Walton era, he was wanting to quit. And that's because the expectations had become so high that he was that it was no fun. so it was fun when he was surprising everybody in the world, and his teams kept winning and winning and winning. That was and everybody kept being amazed. But by the time they won so often, so consistently, that everybody expected his teams to win, then it wasn't any fun. Okay? So he reported that he was in the ego trap and he didn't like it and he considered retiring. So this is, you know, if a guy that, I mean, obviously the expectations were extraordinary. The pressure was tremendous. They call the guy the Wizard of Westwood, for God's sakes. And when they lost once, you know, in I think the early 70s when the Walton team got beat, you know, he considered retiring right then. It's like he just didn't want the pressure because it was no fun. So the idea is that this is not so much a personality issue, it's a human dynamics issue. So when we just about anybody can be ego trapped. And so if we send the social signals in the right way, we can ego trap them, and if we send them in the right way, we can unego trap them. And so what we need to do is learn how to unego trap ourselves by looking to see that feeling of fear and the feeling of potential embarrassment and that it's stopping us from attempting to take on a well worthwhile goal that we can afford financially and we can afford in terms of time and energy, and we have a dream that we feel like we might be able to do this and it would be well worthwhile for us to do it if we could accomplish it, but we're feeling that fear. And if we're feeling that fear, we want to attack it. That's going to be one of the most worthwhile moves that we can ever learn.
Fantastic. Well, we got a caller on hold, so we're going to take this caller in just a second. Yeah,
very
one
good.
Of my really good friends nowadays was my teacher in high school, and we became friends after I was supposed to turn in some assignment, and I did a half-assed job at the very beginning, and then he just basically said, yeah, whatever, you're never going to do a good job, to the point where I just said, you know what, I'm going to prove you wrong, and I ended up doing a really good job on it, and he was really impressed, and we've been friends ever since. So every once in a while, we joke around about, you know, when we're trying to inspire each other to do something, is you're not going to do it, and then
right.
Of course, that ends up being kind of insult thrown back and forth.
Yeah. What's actually really interesting is that one of the things that I will do clinically with people is once I explain the trap to them, and then what I say is I say, you probably can't do it. And they know that this is a joke. They know that it's a joke. They can tell, but it starts to act in the right way. They start to feel the irritation of being underestimated.
Mm-hmm.
And underestimation is a highly motivating force to say, you're not giving me enough status, I'm going to go prove you wrong. Okay? And so even doing it in jest, they can feel it. And this is how you can look inside yourself and identify the ego trap dynamic, because the shift can take place in 10 seconds. So they could be feeling ego trapped, understand it, it's nebulous, it's still hanging around even though they're seeing it, and then I start insulting them. You probably can't get this done. Forget the whole goal. Don't even bother with it. I think you're going to write the great American novel. What are the chances that's going to happen? Never going to happen. Okay? you start needling them, just real friendly. And so for any clinicians out there, or parents or coaches, I mean, there's a little bit of art to that, and you have to earn the fact that the person knows you're totally in their corner, but when you even put on that act for 20 seconds, they can feel it. They can start to feel like there it is, and they can feel what it feels like to be motivated with nothing to lose. Like, you don't think that I can do it? Well, I'm going to bust my rear end now to see whether or not just how close I can get, even if I can't get there. And that tells us how potent the ego trap can be when it comes to dampening our enthusiasm for pursuing our dreams.
Yeah. I had a friend last year who he started eating more a plant food diet, and he would constantly talk to people about it. And people would say the classic line of, I could never do that. So he'd look them up and down and say, I don't think you could do it either.
I love that.
Almost every time, you know,
yes.
A few months later, they come back. They're like, look, I've been on the vegan thing or the Whole Foods thing or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's a thing of beauty. That's just a great line.
Yeah.
All right. So we got a caller?
Yep, we got a caller. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Welcome to the show. Caller going once at the 284, last three numbers of the telephone number. 303? No, I'm not going to say the whole phone number on there. Yeah, going once,
try again
going twice.
Week.
Boom. Sent to outer space. All right.
Okay.
All right, I think...
How do we feel?
Yeah.
Enough for 1 week.
Yeah, enough for 1 week. I think I'm going to rename the show of Just Being Productive and Escaping the Ego Trap. I think we did pretty good.
Yeah.
Our next couple of questions are about whether humans are more emotionally reactive to non-human suffering versus human suffering. And the example this person gives is how Adolf Hitler would describe graphic animal slaughter to convince his friends to become become vegan over dinner. So, a very interesting question. We'll go over it next week.
Okay. All right. Sounds good, Nathan.
All right. Dr. Lau, thanks very much. We'll talk to you next week.
Very good.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.